You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
It's Dear Science with Professor Steve Poynting.
It is Dear Science. Welcome, Steve. How are you?
I'm great, thanks, Dan. Hello. And hi, Martha, too.
Hello.
Yes, and producer Martha Lees is here in studio with us as well. And we're talking about future health. And so I suppose this is just things that we don't have yet, or are they things we have now, but we're kind of, they sound futuristic?
A bit of both, really. They are things we have now, but they're things I think that we often have misconceptions about.
Mm.
And so today is a little bit of myth-busting, but also, you know, just I thought we could have a chat about where these sort of health advances might be taking us as human beings in the future.
Mm. All right, well, let's move on to our first topic, which is laser vision. And are we talking about laser vision here? Are we talking about laser surgery, Steve?
No, it's not laser vision.
Damn it.
I think I've been reading too many Marvel comics, I think. But no, I'm really talking about laser eye surgery. And really, I wanted to start this by going way back and dialing back and just giving a brief scientific explanation for why laser eye surgery even came about in the first place, because it's amazing to me how few people actually understand the basis for why so many of us wear glasses or contact lenses or have surgery. And the simple explanation is really this. So a normal eye, you know, is a, you know, we've got two of them, they're essentially balls of jelly in the front of our head, and what they do is they use a lens at the front of the eye, just behind the cornea, to focus light onto the back of the eyeball, which is known as the retina. And when that focus is perfect and in just the right spot, we're able to see. And, you know, even from school age, I guess we all know about rod cells and cone cells. And, you know, these are touted as the cells that detect light. And many of you may remember that the rod cells are really good for dim light and perceiving black and white, whereas the cone cells are the ones that allow us to see color. And that's why, for example, if you are a dog owner, dogs don't have cone cells, and that's why they don't see any
color. Do they not have cone cells at all?
Well, no, that's not strictly true, but they don't have color cone cells like we do.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But here's the thing, and it was quite a shock to me, that one in four Kiwis have abnormal vision. And, I mean, I was one of those until I had laser surgery, but I'm sitting here in the studio. I mean, you guys are both wearing very nice and very fancy specs, but, you know, it's something
nerd
that...
Nerd alert.
Yeah, it's not... No, it's not nerds, but it's... We're all just very, very clever and good-looking. But what it is this. It's not the fact that it's one in four Kiwis have an eye issue. It's the fact that that number's growing so rapidly. And, you know, I grew up in Hong Kong and spent most of my life there, and 9 out of 10 people in Hong Kong have myopia. Now, myopia is just one form of eye defect. It's what we call short-sightedness or near-sightedness. And that's where essentially the focus of light is happening too soon before it gets to the retina. And that could either be because your eyeball's too big or because your lens is too powerful, which is why people with myopia often, their eyesight improves as they get older and your lens weakens. So my mum, I remember, used to wear glasses and rarely does now. So, you know, that's good news if you're nearsighted. But there's also, of course, the opposite, which is hyperopia or farsightedness, which is where the light is being focused behind your retina, basically, you know, in the bit of your brain. So that's no good either. And then there's also another very common issue, which is called astigmatism. And this is where people start to get confused. And I used to have an astigmatism. And it's basically where you have irregularities on the surface of your cornea, which is the surface of your eyeball. And that causes multiple focal points for light.
Weird.
So basically everything looks blurred. So,
you
know, if like me, you had an astigmatism, often sort of dots appear as fuzzy blurs or lines as opposed to being very sharp.
So by had an astigmatism, are you now going to say you had laser eye surgery?
I did, and I'm going to tell you all about it, because here's the thing. Laser surgery is gaining in popularity and importance here, but it's still way behind other places I've lived. I mean, in Hong Kong, laser surgery has been routine for years, and I had mine 10 years ago now. Mm. I was fairly short-sighted, not awfully, but I had a very bad astigmatism. I used to play a lot of football, and it used to really annoy me that when I wore contact lenses, sometimes if I got a hard hit, they'd fall out. It was no good. So I had the surgery, and I got to tell you, it's the best, one of the best things I've ever done in my life. It changed my life because it's so different. You can't explain this to somebody who's got perfect eyesight, but when you've had to wear glasses and when suddenly you open your eyes and you see everything perfectly, it's a different world.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. There's been an awful lot of bad press or misleading press, I should say, in the last week or two in New Zealand about laser eye surgery, because although the original type was called photorefractive keratotomy, it's not often used anymore. There are basically two types that are used now. One is called LASIK, which is laser-assisted in-situ keratomyliosis, which is the one I had done. And basically, it's a two-step process where they use one laser to sort of slice a flap in your cornea. This sounds gruesome, but
this is going to be fun.
You know, it only takes about a minute. But the worst thing of all, and this is going to sound really awful, but the worst thing for me was the smell, because it smells of cooking. It smells like bacon.
Why?
And I remember being such a worse. I was holding onto the nurse's hand. She said, "Oh, you can squeeze it if you like." And I literally cut the circulation off in her hand. It didn't hurt, but it was the thought that I was being zapped. Anyway.
Okay.
let's get back to the science before I make everyone throw up. So look, here's the thing. So you use two lasers. The second laser reshapes the exposed cornea. So basically, to correct defective eyesight with a laser, you don't reshape the lens. It's very difficult to get in there and fiddle with the lens. What you do is you go into the middle layers of the cornea, that outer area, and you just sort of grind it down a bit with a laser. So the great thing about this is you don't use a knife, so you don't have scar tissue, so you can see great afterwards, and it's non-invasive. The laser goes in there, but you don't stick any nasty objects in there, so it's good. And LASIK's been around for many years and is very popular, but the new type of treatment, which is really only just becoming available in New Zealand, is called SMILE, or small incision lenticule extraction,
which sounds more like a dentist procedure than
it
an
does.
Eye one.
I have to admit that I thought it was the first few times I saw the big words. But here's the thing: this is a kind of a one-step keyhole laser surgery, but again, to correct vision, not to correct teeth. And the whole idea with this is that basically they do something called photoseparation of tissue. They use the laser to create a sort of a series of bubbles that form a disc of the right shape that they want to remove. And then when that disc shape is formed, they then use the hole from the laser just to remove it. So it's a much simpler and faster process. And it's potentially going to, you know, make the whole thing that much easier and that much more reliable. One of the issues with LASIK, of course, is that the more steps in a process you have, you know, the more chance of anything going wrong. But look, as I say, I'm sitting here, I've got 20/20 vision now, and I love it. And I've had my new eyes for 10 years. But there have been a few articles in the press in the last few days and weeks saying that SMILE is not suitable for astigmatism, saying that SMILE is too risky compared to LASIK. But, I trawled through the science literature on this the last few days, and there's no evidence for that as far as I can see. I think it's a question of people perhaps being a little bit afraid of something new. But, I just wanted to give people that little, share a bit of my personal experience that don't be scared of it. It's a very brief procedure. Literally the next day you take your little goggles off that you wear the night of the operation, and it's wonderful. There are risks like with any surgery, but I certainly would urge anyone to seek, you know, medical opinion rather than popular press opinion
exactly,
on this.
But
here's what I wanted to get to, because it is a science show after all. I think that there's a wider issue here that, you know, if we're going to end up like my former home, Hong Kong, where 9 out of 10 people have an eye issue and we correct with surgery, it's going to eventually, and my science heart is speaking now, affect our fitness as a human population. Because if basically we don't select our mates and reproduce, or you know, the success of an individual is not based on our ability to see, it's very possibly, indeed likely, that we could end up with a situation in 10 or 100 years' time where everybody needs to have, at some point in their life, some sort of laser corrective surgery. And especially given how lifestyles are migrating towards, you know, staring at phones and tablets all day long, you know, held very close to your face, you know, that induces myopia in many cases. So I think there's a wider conversation that needs to be held here about not banning in any way these procedures, but you know, how sensible is it that as humans, we, rather than trying to correct issues like that through lifestyle choices, that we're resorting to surgery now more and more to, you know, whether it's, you know, tummy tucks or breast implants or pectoral implants, or I saw one guy the other day had butt implants to make his butt cheeks look better. I mean, why not go to the gym? Anyway, so look, I don't have an answer, but I just do think it's a conversation people need to have.
Big questions, yeah. And yeah, very big questions there, Steve.
Well, it depends how big the implants are.
Yeah. Okay, and so our next story, we're talking about possibly regrowing limbs. I've heard a little bit about this. What's this new study talking about, though, in particular?
Yeah, this, look, it's a study out of the USA from University of Washington, and we've, as you correctly say, in the past, we've featured stories on Dear Science where we've looked at how stem cells can be used in a laboratory setting to grow replacement ears and very simple organs, even perhaps towards regrowing one day things like livers or kidneys. But what's really been out of reach, possibly until now, is the notion of whether we could genetically engineer humans, you and I, to be able to regrow limbs or organs if we were damaged as adults. Because it's all very well growing an ear in a petri dish, but it probably wouldn't look too good. And you know, it's not really, at this time, it's not really a very practical solution. But here's the thing, this team in the US have studied our closest invertebrate relatives. So invertebrates are animals without backbones. But our closest relative is called the acorn worm, and it's kind of an in-between species. It's what we call a hemichordate. So it's got a kind of a rudimentary squidgy backbone, but it's not quite a vertebrate.
But it's still an invertebrate.
Yeah, so it's kind of it's an in-betweeny animal, I guess you could say. But it's the closest sort of invertebrate to sort of advanced mammals that we can find. And here's the thing about acorn worms. They live in coral reefs, you know, in tropical areas, have a lovely life, but they're immortal.
And they're,
they're living gods, if you like.
Okay.
They're immortal for this reason. They can regrow their heads, their proboscis, which is a little sort of feeding apparatus. Mm-hmm. They can grow organs, anything you like. They can regrow if it's damaged or if they're partially fed upon. And so what this study did was say, well, let's have a look at this. And this sounds gruesome, but, you know, because the animals regrew, I'm not going to get on my sort of vivisection bandwagon with this one. So these investigators took a bunch of these worms and they chopped off their proboscis, which is a bit like you and me having our sort of mouth and nose chopped off. They removed kidneys and all sorts of things. But here's the thing. They noticed they regrew in all the animals within about 5 to 10 days, and the animals were perfectly fine. But they didn't just regrow as if they were developmentally growing in an infant or a baby. They regrew to the exact same size and shape and function as the previous one in the adult. And moreover, when the worms were just chopped in half, the bottom half, which was the bottom, regrew a new head and new kidneys and new lymph system and nervous system. And likewise, the head end grew a new bottom and whatever. And that all took about 2 weeks. So these animals are truly immortal. And so what the scientists wanted to do was say, look, we know that an awful lot of genes that are present in that acorn worm are also present in humans. And it probably includes the ones that control this regeneration process. But this regeneration process is clearly not the same as development, where, you know, we're a bunch of cells inside the womb and we suddenly grow a heart or a kidney. This is growing a new adult replacement.
Yeah. Mm.
So what the scientists were able to do was find a whole bunch of genes that were activated during this process. And they have come to sort of a mini conclusion, if you like, that there's a control switch somewhere in this genetic apparatus that controls the whole thing. They're not quite sure what it is yet.
It's always one switch, isn't it? One big button.
They always want one button. This is a problem with science, you see. They always want, you know, a one-stop solution, but it's likely to be a whole suite of things.
Yeah.
Life is never that easy, really. But here's the thing. The pathway that allowed all this to happen is being studied now in cells in these worms. And what they're finding is those pathways are more than likely also present in humans. So what this team have done from Washington U is hypothesize that the reason it's not happening in humans is not because we don't have the genetic machinery to make it happen, but because probably we've got another mechanism that's preventing it happening. And they postulate that scar tissue. And of course, scarring and scar tissue is an adaptation that we, especially as mammals, have evolved to cope with wounds and injury as we've evolved, you know, from cave people up to the present day. So the next step in this research is, of course, to try and take an animal a little bit more complex, in this case a zebrafish, and see whether they can switch on that regeneration apparatus and try and establish whether or not, you know, scarring is part of the process or the inhibition of the process.
Oh, weird. Oh,
Would you want to I mean, if you lost an arm accidentally, would you want to regrow it?
See, yeah, it sounds strange now, but I suppose if you have a missing arm, I mean, that your perspective completely changes, so probably.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure with a human body, because we're quite large and complex, quite how we would go about doing that and how long it would take. And energetically on a human body, it would be a huge demand. But
yeah,
hey, you know, I think, I mean, I'm really looking forward, when we said future science day, this is science for way, way in the future.
Yeah, exactly.
When we may be living on spaceships or on Mars and not have access to you know, surgery that's life-saving. And so, you know, to me, it's all suggesting that we may be having to face the reality at some point in our distant future of genetically altering ourselves to adapt to a new environment, because that's what evolution is. I mean, we're perfectly adapted to Earth right now, but, you know, we're screwing up Earth pretty quickly. And so, you know, all of this, I think, especially, you know, among the sort of astrobiology research community, is being taken quite seriously.
Mm. And we are running a little bit low on time, but we will get to the very last story quickly. The latest weapon in the fight against addiction, weed.
Yeah. Hey, look, this is good news for everyone, I guess.
Yes, it is.
So, look, this is a study just published in the Clinical Psychology Review, one of the best and most respected journals in the field of clinical psychology, basically saying, and I'll be quick because, as you said, we're running out of time. It's a study out of Canada from University of British Columbia. Canada's on the verge of legalizing marijuana for recreational and medical use, and they wanted a balanced view of all the research that's been done the last 20, 30 years on marijuana, because, you know, everything from the reefer madness ads by the US, you know, there's, mm-hmm. there's so much negative spin and positive spin where it perhaps shouldn't be. So here's the thing. Conclusive proof that marijuana, weed, ganja, whatever you want to call it, is a positive benefit with people who are fighting more serious addictions, particularly opiates and alcohol.
Mm.
And so as a therapeutic, there's certainly a future for it there. It also found a very positive link between the use of marijuana and effective treatment for PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder, for depression, and also a whole range of other disease symptoms, specifically for things like glaucoma, which, you know, you listen to Pete Tosh records, he's been talking about this for decades, you know.
Mm.
So, you know, it's nothing that new, but this kind of vindicates what a lot of people have been saying anecdotally. But what it also did crucially is say what it's not good for, because, you know, there's always a rough and a smooth. So bipolar disorder and most types of psychoses are not treatable with marijuana. But what this study did, I think, is for the first time provide an unbiased, you know, unpolicy focused view, you know, purely scientific view on what can marijuana do and what can it not do? And perhaps for me, one of the most important things was that it supported the widespread opinion that marijuana does lead to cognitive impairment. I mean, it's a simple fact. I mean, people get arrested. You know, you watch these driving shows, cop shows on TV. If people have been smoking weed or ingesting it in any way, don't drive. It's bloody stupid. You know, there is a causal link between ingesting this compound and impairment. So, you know, I think now that argument is firmly put to bed. But it also busted some other myths, and specifically the myth which was especially put forward by the US government for many years, that marijuana users were more prone to physical violence, both to themselves and to others. And this has been disproved by this rather thorough review of the literature. So look, there's good news, there's bad news, but I think it's nice that we're at least approaching this with a balanced viewpoint at last.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for your time, Steve, and get on to it, New Zealand government. Just another piece of information there that, you know, we should be following the rest of the world, possibly having a good look at legalising the substance. Thank you very much, Steve.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.